Every time you go to a new place, you get a rush, a feeling of excitement mingled with fear that brings a sparkle to your eye and turns your heartbeat up just a few notches. That is our brain telling us through little spurts of dopamine, yes, go forward, explore. Research shows that novelty, rather than being a reward in itself, is the motivator that drives us to seek rewards. It's why you obsessively play that new level in a video game until you beat it. It's why you decide on a whim to take a new route to work on a sunny day. It's why our storytellers this week chose to embark on trips to unfamiliar surroundings and found themselves in some pretty hairy situations.
There's a good chance that if I tell this story that multiple foreign governments are going to be upset.
Because the truth is that that was as far as my plan went. And it wasn't a very good plan to begin with.
So, get with your family, your friends, acquaintances, that stranger you've been wanting to meet. Make your plate. Pour yourself a drink. We'd like to share some stories with you. We'd like you to take them in and think and talk and tell stories of your own. For Critical Point Theater, I'm Lanny Fu. Thank you for bringing us into your home for this Sunday night supper. They traveled overseas and across state lines in pursuit of adventure and fulfillment. And they are here to share their experiences. For our first course, we have Andrew telling us the story of a recent college graduate version of Andrew taking his first subway ride in New York City.
Someone once gave me the piece of advice that when you graduate college, that is the best time in your life to immediately make a really big, bold decision. I don't remember who told me that, but I must have held them in high esteem because that's what I did. I graduated from a college in Virginia on May 13th, 2012, and on May 28th, I was on a bus up to New York City. I was splitting a room with another person named Andrew, and I apologize for any confusion that's going to happen in this story because we're both named Andrew. We were splitting a room together, a really overpriced room on the Lower East Side of Manhattan. Being a recent college graduate, I was used to the question of, oh, what is the plan for what you're going to do with your life? And I would say, well, I'm going to go up to New York and do this 10-week acting program. And then if they said, yeah, but what are you going to do after that? I would change the subject immediately. Because the truth is that that was as far as my plan went. And it wasn't a very good plan to begin with. I had never had like a real job before. I didn't do a lot of things that normal adults do every day in their life. I was not ready to go do this. But I did it anyway. I was undeterred. And the first night that me and Andrew were in our new apartment in New York, this was a Friday night, we were going to go to the Upper West Side to meet some friends of ours up there to like go out and drink and have a party. Neither Andrew nor I had ridden the subway before. In fact, I think the two of us had collectively spent maybe 2 weeks of our life in New York, like at all. Not even just in the city, but in the state of New York. But again, we were like, I'm sure we can figure it out. It's not that different than the Metro, which the other Andrew had also never been on. So we got on what we thought was the right train, and we get into the subway, and we sit down. Everything that you hear about New York, about how it can be rude or there can be a harsh city, we weren't getting any of that. Sitting next to us were these two very old Chinese guys who were speaking in Mandarin, and it was like comedy hour, like on the subway. They were talking to each other, telling laughs, and like having belly laughs. And sitting right across from me was this middle-aged guy who was smiling and gave me the typical New York welcome of, how you doing? And I was like, oh my God, New York is the most magical place in the world. Everyone's so nice here. A little bit more about the two guys, the Chinese guys sitting next to me. It sounded like they were doing Yo Mama jokes, like that kind of thing. And one of them would say one joke and the other would die laughing. And then it'd be the other guy's turn and he would go back. It was like watching Statler and Waldorf, the Muppets in the Balcony from the Muppets, but in Chinese. And then we were like, man, they're having a great time. And that was actually like really comforting to see that happening next to me. So one of the guys stands up and delivers what must be like the best joke that he knows. And he delivers it with this gusto, and it's so funny that he can't even get it out of his mouth without doubling over laughing. So me and Andrew look over at the other guy to see how he's going to react. And he stands up as well, looks the other guy in the face with a smile on, takes his palm, open hand, and smacks the shit out of him. The look on me and Andrew's faces changed dramatically. What we thought was these two old guys yucking it up was actually much more like the scene in True Romance where Christopher Walken and Dennis Hopper are calling each other eggplants and laughing, knowing well that they're both going to pull out their guns. These guys were in like a heated debate from like centuries of like awful things that have happened. And they start having a fight like from a kung fu movie. And I'm not saying it's a kung fu movie because they were two Asian guys. No, it was like, it was almost choreographed looking. It was so, the jabs were so fast and they were blocking and it was quick and they obviously knew where they were punching and like, it was amazing and frightening. And it was right in front of me, right in front of my face. I've rented UFC pay-per-views where the main event is far less coordinated than these guys were. And at this point, Andrew is clutching, not me. The other Andrew is clutching onto my arm and he's going, we have to get off the next stop. We have to get off the next stop. Okay, we're going off the next stop. And the guy sitting across from me who had introduced himself earlier, I think realized that we were both about to poop our pants. He tries to get the guys to stop fighting, but he thinks this is funny because he's a veteran New Yorker. And he goes, hey, come on, guys, stop fighting. We got kids here. So the men continue to fight and we get to the next stop and Andrew lifts me up and we run through the middle of them, haymakers coming past my head in all directions, and we get off of the train and we don't know where we are. Luckily, we were only like a stop away from where we were going to go. So we're like, great, we're going to be able to go to the apartment. Bad news is we were in the Lower East Side trying to go to the Upper West and we just went straight up. So we are on the wrong side of Central Park at like 11 o'clock at night on a Friday. So we start walking through Central Park with like the part of it where there's no lights, the part where most Law and Order episodes like start the next day. And we're walking and we haven't said anything since getting off the subway. And Andrew goes, do you have your keys with you? I go, yeah. He's like, you should probably put them in between your fingers just in case. And I don't ask him what the just in case is about. I just hope that we won't have to see it. Somehow we get through Central Park and we get to the apartment that our friends are at. And we get there and we put on our happy face and we go drinking and have a good time. And I'm trying to have fun. And I know in my mind instantly, I will not be staying here. I will not be living here. I've made a terrible mistake. I have no plans. I have no direction. So 10 weeks go by, my classes end, and I go back to Virginia, broke, terrified, having a quarter-life crisis because I don't know what my next step is. So I use the next 2 years to become a functional adult. I do things like get a job and make like a budget and do taxes. Which apparently you don't have to do as an adult, but it's you should. I decide that this time I'm going to go back up to New York. I'm now a more functional person. I can do this. I go up my first time back in New York. I go up in February of 2014. A play that I wrote was in a festival up there. And one of the crew members on our show, her name was Sadie. She had not been to a town with three lanes of traffic before, let alone the metropolis that is New York City. And the first day we're up there, we are getting on the subway to bring props over to the theater. And everything is fine. It is a normal subway ride. And then you hear the sounds familiar to lots of New Yorkers of a boombox being turned on. And three guys in jumpsuits walking down the aisle of the subway, like clapping their hands. And it is the very typical for anyone who's from here, not for people who don't know what's going on, the Subway B-Boy team is there going around dancing and asking for money. And of course, all the New Yorkers are not reacting to this at all. They are stoic as if nothing is going on. And I look at Sadie and she has this look of confusion and horror as to what is going on. And I realize, oh, that's exactly what I must have looked like when those Asian guys were beating the crap out of each other. And it's the first time in my life that I'm like, you know what? Oh, I can chuckle to this. This is funny. I understand what it's like to be the guy who was sitting across from me saying, how are you doing? And I find myself in New York now with more of a direction. I don't know if it will work out, but at the very least, I know how to read a subway map.
Cool. When was the last time you found yourself so lost, with no idea about where your life was going? What did you do to figure it out? Or what did you do to avoid the question? Tell that story. We'll be right back. Nick was raised in a swirl of different cultures, and that sense of attraction to diverse cultures, to the excitement of travel, is still strong in her today. For our second course, here is Nick Allier with what begins as a pseudo-spiritual journey that soon spirals out of control.
So, I come from a very odd family, culturally. My father is a U.S. Foreign Service officer, commonly known as a diplomat, and my mother is from Turkey, and the two of them met on my father's very first assignment, which was in Turkey. So I grew up with one Muslim parent and one Jewish parent from New Jersey. My dad was very culturally Jewish, but was not practicing in any way. And when my parents got divorced and my dad remarried, he remarried and he converted to becoming a Presbyterian with his new wife. So I wasn't Muslim. I wasn't Jewish. I wasn't Christian. I was just confused. I spent a lot of my childhood hearing about the sort of religious environments my friends were growing up in and not being able to relate to them at all in any way because my life was so different from theirs. And I also spent a lot of my childhood traveling to go see my father wherever he was. I think by the time I was 20, when this story picks up, I'd been to something like 20 or 21 countries. Quite a lot. Something most people will never achieve in their entire life. So my junior year of college, I get the opportunity to go on Birthright. For those of you who don't know what Birthright is, it's a sponsored trip to Israel for Jewish youths who have never been to Israel. So I interview and I'm accepted. I can't believe I'm accepted. I can't believe I'm Jewish enough. And we book the trip. And I don't know anyone really going on the trip. And so I say, screw it, I'm going to make some new friends. It's going to be great. And we leave on Christmas Day because, of course, we do. And we have a great time. I mean, the trip is really fun. It's a great cultural mix of sightseeing and learning about the country's history. And one of the things that you can do on Birthright is get sort of a shotgun bar/bat mitzvah. Now, I didn't do this, but a couple of the girls on my trip did it. And the rabbi who speaks to Birthright groups came to speak to us that night for the ceremony. And he's talking to us, and he said something really that stuck with me about how our ancestors had gone through so much, and they had fought for so much so that those who came after them in their family could be in this place that they valued so much and that they found so holy. And I lose it. I mean, I had gone on this trip not expecting to have any sort of change, any sort of emotional reaction, feel any sort of ownership of this land. I mean, I had been raised by mostly Muslim parents, so for me it was kind of like, okay, haha, let's go check it out. And this rabbi says this, and I'm bawling. I mean, I'm losing it, silently losing it. And my friends, my newfound really close friends, are looking at me being like, what's wrong with you? What's going on? Because for them, it's just one in a million, you know? They're going to these things all the time, hearing it all the time. But for me, that was the first time in my life that I had felt that I identified with any religious group. And it wasn't necessarily about the teachings of the religion, but it had to do with my family members that I never knew fighting for me when I didn't even know that they had wanted that or that they had fought for me. It had never really occurred to me. So I go to Israel, I have this sort of powerful, unexpected experience. I have a really wonderful time. And I had had a sort of difficult time getting into the country to begin with. They sort of question you, and someone had said to me, you know, it's not about the answers to the questions, it's about how you answer the questions. So I was very perky and bubbly when they were asking me, and it turns out, I mean, the answers to the questions do matter. They were kind of freaked out that I didn't have a return ticket with my group, and that I had this Arabic name, and so I had sort of a tough go getting into the country, but once I was there, everything was great. So cut to the end of the trip, and I'm leaving to go visit my father in Uzbekistan, where he's stationed. And I get to the airport, and I'm sort of ready for them to have at me again and to question me again. And they start going through my, like, dirty laundry from 10 days of backpacking and being in hostels and, you know, being on farms. And I just started crying again because I, you know, I felt like part of the team now, and I had nothing left to hide and no judgments left. And they kind of saw, they're like, okay, well, we broke this one. She's one of us. You know, we succeeded, and they let me go. And I think I spent 4 hours in the Tel Aviv airport sort of just sitting still and staring at a wall because I didn't know what to do with myself anymore. So I finally get on this flight to Uzbekistan, and it's me and like 150 drunk Israelis who are on their way to some vacation spot nearby. So we get through this flight. It's literally one of the loudest flights I've ever been on in my life, and I've been on a lot of flights with a lot of different cultural groups of people, and it's insane. We finally get to Tashkent. It's like 2 a.m, and they start yelling at us to get off the plane. I mean, these Israelis are sort of anarchists. They're getting up with the seatbelt sign on, and they've started moving all their stuff around, and the flight attendants are going berserk. And they shuffle us off the back of the plane, and you hit the tarmac, and it's snowing, and there are people in furry hats yelling at you in Russian, and there were two buses. There was a bus with 4 people on it, and there was a bus with everybody else on it. All of my newfound Israeli friends were on the big bus. And one of the biggest lessons my father taught me when I traveled was to follow the crowds. You're always safer when you follow the crowds. So I followed the crowd, and I got on the bus, and I ended up in the transfers hall because, of course, the Israelis weren't going to Uzbekistan. Why would they? So I'm walking around this transfer hall looking for a door out, and I walk up to a group of police officers who are standing around shooting the shit, and I say, hi, how do I get out of here? And they all sort of turn and look at me, and they start laughing, and they say, honey, we don't speak English. And I'm done. I'm so stressed out. I'm so exhausted at this point. I'm like, screw this country. How do I do anything? I don't even remember how I got out. I think I ended up sneaking through a bunch of random hallways. Some guy shoved me through a door, and magically I was in customs. Not good advice. Nobody follow that advice in the future. And I have this trip, and I'm only there for like maybe 4 or 5 days before I have to go back to school. And it's cold, and it's snowy, and miserable, and everybody was so hard to talk to. And it was the first time I left a country thinking, ugh, I do not need to go back to this place. So cut to a year later, it's my spring break for my senior year, and my dad says, hey, you know, you're getting older, this is the last time we can sort of get you out here, like, and take care of a ticket, do you want to come? And I was like, screw it, I mean, all my friends are going to the beach, let's go to Uzbekistan, spring break 2013, woo-woo, senior year. So I go to Uzbekistan for spring break. I find this great direct flight, Turkish Air. If you ever get a chance to fly Turkish Air, do it. It's like 1,000 movies. I watched The Godfather. I took this beautiful flight. I got straight there. I got there during the daylight. And I'm there for a week. And it's wonderful. We went to Samarkand and we saw all of these incredible historical sites that nobody is seeing, that nobody is at. And, you know, in the United States, we have like maybe 300 years of history. And in Uzbekistan, they have thousands and thousands and thousands of years of history. And they are such a huge cultural mixing pot. I mean, you can't look at a person on the street and say, oh, that guy's Uzbek, because they have such a wide range of ethnicities that have migrated there over the years. And I find myself on this trip, and I am so grateful that I went back. the people were so sweet to me. I had time to settle in, and it's sunny, and I learned so much, and it was just, it felt like a completely different place to me. And both of those experiences, when you tie them together, they were so poignant for me because all of my expectations that I had of both of those places were completely wrong. Completely wrong. And I came out of both of them feeling really changed. So that was a big lesson for me as a human being after all these years of traveling and sort of being tossed around, is that a lot of places aren't what they seem until you go there and you really open yourself up to them. And I found that to be one of the most valuable things I've learned in life. Thank you.
Have you ever had a time when you felt a certain kind of kismet just take a hold of your life? And it didn't matter what you did, you were being swept along and you better just hang on for the ride? Share that story. We'll be back in a moment. The other cool thing about novelty is how intricately linked it is to learning. New stimuli improves the plasticity of the hippocampus, which refers to the brain's ability to create new connections between neurons, meaning you learn better, faster, and remember more when old information is mixed with new information. So, I think our storytellers this week will join me in saying, when in doubt, take the plunge. As Andrew's friend said in so many words, in times of great disorientation, make a bold choice to do something totally new and terrifying. The risks may be astronomical, but it will quite literally make your brain work better. And chances are it'll lead to something unexpectedly wonderful. Tonight, let's toast to releasing yourself into the unknown and to coming out the other side, whole, wise, and just a little bit braver than before. Sunday Night Supper is a production of CPT Broadcasting, the audio storytelling arm of Critical Point Theater, an ensemble-based performance company. You can hear more about what we do, including other podcasts, at www.criticalpointtheater.com. That is two T's and theater with an R-E. Critical Point Theater is a sponsored project of Fractured Atlas, a nonprofit arts service organization. Sunday Night Supper is produced by Executive Director Julia Katz, Associate Director Lanny Fu, Podcast Production Manager Chelsea Rugg, and the head honcho of CPT Podcasts, Andrew Terrence Caberline. Thanks to Nick Allier and Andrew for contributing their stories. And thank you for spending your time with us. See you next Sunday. Good night.